Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll try to sort out what's happening in Saudi Arabia with Madawi Al-Rashid. She's a professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and she's from Saudi Arabia, so it'll be good to get her take on all of the palace intrigue, the Game of Thrones, Saudi style. Then we'll be joined by Gabriel Zuckman from UC Berkeley. Professor Zuckman is the author of The Hidden Wealth of Nations, The Scourge of Tax Havens. And we'll talk to him about the so-called Paradise Papers, this trove of leaked documents that are giving us some fresh insights into the nature of the plutocracy. And if we have time, I'm not sure we will, we'll talk a little bit about last Tuesday's elections and what they might mean going forward. But first, Vladimir Putin seems to have put that whole Russian meddling thing to bed. The issue is now settled. That is according to Donald Trump. He told reporters this week, and I quote, "Putin said he didn't meddle. He said he didn't meddle. I asked him again. You can only ask so many times. Every time he sees me, he says, I didn't do that." Let's pause here. Every time he sees me, he says, I didn't do that. So he'll meet Vladimir Putin, you know, at Starbucks, while he's waiting for his, like, latte, and Vladimir will be just like, I didn't do that. Trump went on to say, and I really believe that when he tells me that, he means it. But he says, I didn't do that. I think he is very insulted by it. So we have insulted Vladimir Putin. By the way, Gleb Pavlovsky, a former high-level advisor to Vladimir Putin, told PBS's Frontline, and I quote, "I don't know who believed in America that Putin elected Trump, but Putin believed that. Putin believed that." And it's true. I don't know anyone who thinks Putin elected Trump, that the Russians were responsible for Trump's, for the Trump presidency. It seems to be a popular straw man among Russian skeptics, right? Like if the Russians didn't single-handedly elect Trump, then we should just be okay with it all, with their efforts to do so. I think a better way of thinking about it is that Russian disinformation contributed significantly to a broader effort to create the perception that a competent center-left Democrat wasn't just too friendly with Wall Street and large donors, which is true, but was in fact venal and corrupt to a degree that made it acceptable to vote for a crackpot reality TV star like Donald Trump. It made it acceptable to go into that polling booth and pull that lever for a guy who was caught on tape bragging about his propensity for sexual assault. This is what the Russian campaign helped to do. And you could argue that Hillary Clinton ran a bad campaign. I won't dispute that. You can argue that her speeches to Wall Street and high-flying foundation work, the Clinton Global Initiative and their annual shindig rich hotspots. You can argue that all of that undermined the Democrats' message about how harmful inequality is, or their charges that the Republicans only care about their wealthy donors. You can make all of those arguments, but all of the charges that she was effectively bribed over weapon sales, or the Uranium One nonsense, or that she imperiled national security, or with the emails, or gave a stand-down order to keep help from getting to Benghazi. All of the stories of supposed quid pro quos, or corruption, or actual harm were nonsense. There was nothing there. You can't say that Russia created those stories. You can't say that they created that narrative about crooked Hillary. They didn't. They amplified it. They reinforced it in a highly targeted fashion, and they spent a lot of resources to do so. They put a lot into it. They weren't alone. The media that focused almost exclusively on Clinton's supposed scandals played a huge role in that. I mean, we had the Yoshi Bankler from Harvard's what was it called? The Shorenstein Center. They did that study that found that the, I'm sorry, it was the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard, had that study that showed that in that the mainstream press devoted a disproportionate amount of coverage to Emailgate and all of that stuff. That played a huge role. I mean, former FBI Director James Comey with his 11th hour press conference announcing basically nothing had a huge role, right? It guaranteed that the email story would dominate in the last week and a half of the race. And of course, Americans on the left as well as the right shared some responsibility for that as well. Shared the lion's share of responsibility. But they did so out of partisan zeal, or in the case of the media, to demonstrate their impartiality, or for whatever reason, or for whatever motivated Comey. Right? I think part of that was to try to deflect criticism from the right, but I don't know what was in his head. But many of us are more angry about the Russians' role. And we should be, right? And not just because they're a foreign power. It's because Vladimir Putin is a ruthless authoritarian nationalist who resents the post-World War II international order, wants to make Russia great again. And in his view, that means freeing it from the constraints upon it, the constraints imposed upon it by the International Criminal Court, NATO, and the Paris Agreement, and European sanctions, etc., etc. And he kills dissidents and journalists, and he passed a law targeting Russia's LGBT community, calling them pedophiles. And we should be angry because they intervened not on behalf of like a generic Republican like Mitt Romney, but on behalf of Donald Trump. Right? And we should resent that they appear to have focused on exacerbating our existing social and political divides, right? They impersonated American Islamophobes and American Muslims and white supremacists and anti-fascists and cops and Black Lives Matter, and they're still doing it. Their accounts are promoting the idea that that football players should take a knee, and they're promoting the idea that this is a protest against the national anthem or the flag rather than police violence. They did it to stir the pot, to set us against each other. And again, those divisions existed. We can't say they created them, but we sure as hell should be furious about a strategy of driving these wedges deeper into our what do you want to call it? Social fabric, right? I get tired of all the straw men around Russia. It's exhausting. Anyway, let's take a quick break and then get on with the show. Stay tuned. We'll speak with Madawi al-Rashid right after the break.
Slang when you notice the stripes. it's right when you die. Old and bony, dawn breaks like a bolt through the hall. Never should've called, but my head's to the wall and I'm lonely. And if you turn to me like a gull takes to the wind, I'd have jumped. Godspeed, all the beggars are done. They all cut their thumbs and bleed into their buns till they melt away. I'm looking in on the good life I might do never to find. Without a trust, the flaming fields am I too dumb to refine. And if you turn to me like rain, I'd dance like a queen of the eyesores, and the rest of our lives were fed well.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland. Last Saturday, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's often referred to as MBS, made an aggressive move to consolidate power. That's perhaps understating it. Arresting over a dozen other members of the Saudi royal family and senior ministers in an ostensible crackdown on corruption. This occurred amid really ratcheting up tensions in the Middle East. The same day, the Saudis say they intercepted a long-range missile fired at Riyadh by Houthi rebels in Yemen. Lebanese Prime Minister Saeed Hariri, a Saudi ally, resigned in Saudi Arabia that same day. He said that he feared an assassination plot by Iranian-backed Hezbollah that sent Lebanon into a fresh political crisis. It has since been reported that Hariri is under house arrest in Saudi Arabia, is being detained by MBS. The Saudis called both moves, both Hariri's claim that he was fearful of a assassination attempt and the long-range missile fired from Yemen, they called both moves acts of war. And on Thursday, they ordered their citizens to leave Lebanon. To help us sort out this story, I'm very pleased to welcome Madawi Al-Rashid. Professor Al-Rashid is a visiting professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and she joins me now by phone from London. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start out just by briefly setting the stage here. Is this, is everything we've seen the last week, is it a culmination of a competition for power that began with King Abdullah's death in 2015?
Yes, absolutely. In 2015, we saw how many crown princes failed to become kings after Salman became king. So he immediately sacked his brother Migrin, who was the crown prince, and appointed Mohammed bin Nayef, who is much younger. But we see that in recent times, he also got rid of Mohammed bin Nayef and promoted his own son, Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as MBS. So there has been a change at the level of succession in Saudi Arabia. Historically, the succession went from one person to his brother. But with King Salman in 2015, we see that there was a move towards making it go from father to son along the European model of monarchy. And there are several reasons for this. First, the brothers of Salman are old, and none of the remaining ones are actually good enough to become kings. So Salman didn't face a great opposition when he sidelined all his remaining brothers. Now, his choice of Mohammed bin Salman, the youngest son, was controversial. He immediately placed him in high position, such as Minister of Defense, first initially as Deputy Crown Prince, but then became Crown Prince. He amassed so much power in his hands and maintaining his control over the media, over the military apparatus of the Saudi regime, the intelligence services, which paved the way for the recent detentions. And I would imagine that the detention of the commander of the Saudi Arabian National Guard, Prince Mit'ab bin Abdullah, was actually the removal of the last rival of that generation of cousins of Mohammed bin Salman, who can potentially challenge his leadership simply because they are in command of troops on the ground, such as the SANG or the Saudi Arabian National Guard.
Now, MBS's moves have been described as a departure from longstanding norms of Saudi governance, which tended to stress, I guess, a sometimes difficult process of creating some consensus within the royal family. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes. Well, at the moment, we can't really talk about consensus. Mohammed bin Salman has shattered the consensus of the Saudi royal family because he, the senior princes who had been detained, this is unprecedented in the history of the Saudi state. To get people like Commander Mit'ab bin Abdullah or entrepreneur Al-Walid bin Talal or even other princes, he detained 11 so far, is unprecedented. The only time we've had princes detained is when they committed criminal acts, and they would be like put under house arrest. And even the ones who challenged the rule of the Al Saud in the 1950s and 60s, such as the Free Princes, eventually there was a pardon. They came back to Saudi Arabia. They were invited to come back, and they were forgiven. But this detention, even if there are serious charges, it's just undermined the status of these other princes and proved to the world and to Saudis that there's only one man who's running the show in Saudi Arabia, and that is Mohammed bin Salman.
What has been Salman's vision 2030, and what do you make of the claims that this move to consolidate power was a means of overcoming resistance to the kind of sweeping change that he envisions for the Saudi kingdom, that he was trying to overcome defenders of the status quo?
Well, there are multiple issues here. Saudi Vision 2030 builds on previous development projects in Saudi Arabia, and it's not that new. For example, privatization had already started in Saudi Arabia. Saudization, and that is replacing the expatriate labor force with Saudis, had always been part of the government policy since the 1970s. However, what's new in this vision is the following. The IPO that is planned for Aramco, the oil company, it's not going to happen soon because the project is stumbling and they still don't know whether they're going to do it in New York or in London, or possibly the Chinese are going to buy a huge chunk of it. So this is up in the air. But this is the novelty of this vision, that it touches the oil sector, which is the main economic sector in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia depends on oil for at least like 75% of its income. So Mohammed bin Salman's vision is to float 5% of the oil company. The other aspect of Mohammed bin Salman's vision is to engineer social change from above, which means that he envisages Saudi Arabia to become more open in order to attract foreign investors. For his projects to succeed, at least the economic one, he needs an open society, an open environment. However, the openness that we have seen so far is very superficial. So women's driving is extremely important. But the real question is, why have Saudi women been denied the right to drive until the 21st century? And there are other rights that they have not got. But the driving ban is very sensational. And as everybody knows, hundreds of articles in the Western media have been written about it as if it is the culmination of a great social transformation or revolution, which in fact is not the case, because there are certain restrictions, legal issues that need to be resolved. Then thirdly, there is the claim that Mohammed bin Salman wants to start a moderate Islam, bringing back Saudi Arabia to a kind of religious moderation. And here, when he announced that, he was actually not very, very accurate when it comes to history. The Saudi regime has always been built on a radical version of Islam, namely the Salafis or the Wahhabis. And to claim, as he did, that since 1979, Saudis became radical as a result of Iran, thus blaming it on Iran, this is totally untrue, because those of us who spend most of our time reading the archives and looking at Saudi history, we realize that this is absolute rubbish. It's not true at all. Saudi Arabia had always been radical. But let's assume that he's going to make Saudi Arabia endorse moderate Islam. How is he going to do it when he has actually put in prison so many religious scholars and clerics who are not radical at all? To give you one example, cleric Salman Al-Ouda, who was associated with this Islamist trend, recently announced that we cannot prosecute homosexuals in this world. Let's just leave it as a topic and not actually enforce a punishment or impose punishment on those people. So this kind of development in religious thinking had been objected to by Mohammed bin Salman, who put this religious cleric in prison in September, together with a whole range of other people. So, for example, there is the founders of a Saudi civil society by the name of Hassan, which means the civil and political association in Saudi Arabia. Since 2009, they've been imprisoned simply because they formed an independent civil society calling for human rights. So when Salman became king, he did not pardon them. When Mohammed bin Salman became crown prince, he continued to put them in prison. Some of them are above 75-year-old, and they're going to die in prison simply because they dared to ask for civil and political rights in Saudi Arabia and express their opinion. So this repression is really not the right environment to create moderate Islam.
This is Joshua Holland, and I'm speaking with Professor Madawi Al-Rashid from the London School of Economics and Political Science. It's interesting that you mentioned the driving issue, because that really did get so much positive press coverage in the Western media. Some observers pointed out that the decree only tasked a ministerial committee to study how it could be done consistently with the Saudi interpretation of Islamic law. And others said it was a kind of a distraction from the regime's human rights record. Let me ask you this. This crackdown has been couched as an assault on corruption. How do you define corruption in a monarchy where the line between the royal family and the state is so fuzzy? And is that framing something that's resonating with the Saudi public?
Yes. Well, the Saudi public had cheered this move that now we're having a new policy whereby anybody who's suspected of being corrupt is going to be detained, put on trial. But one thing that dictators usually do, if they want to get rid of their opponents or rivals, they can always fabricate a kind of case against them and claim that they are corrupt and put them in prison. And we've seen this in other countries, from China to Iran to other places. And therefore, Mohammed bin Salman is not doing anything new. And by putting his rivals in detaining them under the pretext of fighting anti-corruption, he's trying to entertain, sort of like augment his popularity in the eyes of the Saudi public and also the foreign investors. But this had proved to be counterproductive, because we found that since the detention, which took place on the 4th of November, the Saudi stock market was declining, and a lot of people are abroad who may have considered investing in Saudi are thinking about, you know, the rule of law and what it means to do business and put a lot of money in a country that that lacks transparency, that lacks the rule of law and an independent judiciary. And those foreign investors in the US and Europe, in Japan and other places, must think twice about investing in a country like Saudi Arabia, when you actually don't know what will happen to your money. In the short term, these investors may make a lot of money, but at any minute they could be detained and put in the Ritz-Carlton, or even worse, in the Saudi Al-Hayer prison for any reason, because this autocrat is proved to be erratic, young, and in a hurry to make a lot of money, but at the expense of people who have lost their liberty under the pretext of fighting corruption, or even under the pretext of fighting the war on terror. So he claimed in September, when all those people were detained, professionals, activists, religious scholars, that they were all radical. And this is absolutely not true. According to Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, those people have not been involved in violence. In fact, a lot of them have been just peaceful critics of the regime. And some of them are not even critic. Some of them have abstained from applauding every policy that Mohammed bin Salman had introduced, and they were punished for their silence.
I'm going to switch tacks here a little bit and talk about the U.S. relationship with the Saudi regime, with MBS. He has been embraced as a reformer by the Washington, D.C. foreign policy establishment. The Trump regime has adopted a kind of, they haven't said this much, but they've adopted an unspoken Saudi-first Middle East policy. In part, I think that's a reflection of their hawkish view towards Iran. And a number of analysts have argued that the administration's kind of uncritical embrace of MBS and of King Salman bin Abdulaziz has emboldened the prince and given him the sense that he can make these kind of radical changes without any repercussions from the outside world. Is that your view, or are we giving Washington too much credit for its influence over these events?
Well, there are two issues here. Quite a lot of the stuff that is going in Saudi Arabia, very pleasant things like detentions, repression, and sidelining of princes. This has got to do with the domestic power struggle in Saudi Arabia at the very top level, i.e. at the level of the royal family. But Mr. Trump, since he became president, he had given positive signals to Mohammed bin Salman, especially in his regional policies. And here there are two examples. The first one is in Yemen. Trump remained silent on Saudi atrocities and airstrikes in Yemen, in as much as Mr. Obama had been. Both presidents had not actually made any noise to warn Saudis again for the humanitarian crisis that they had precipitated in Yemen. So and the other crisis that happened since Mr. Trump became president is the crisis with Qatar. And here, Mr. Trump has just simply endorsed what the Saudis told him in Riyadh when he visited. And they told him that, well, Qatar is the one that sponsors terrorism. And he seemed to have repeated that like a parrot. I'm sorry to say, without any kind of investigation. And here we have a situation where he was trying to endear the prince. And I think they have a lot in common. So Mohammed bin Salman is a young version of Mr. Trump. They both think that money could solve all problems. So when he became president, he simply looked down on those Gulf people and the Gulf governments, and he said that they only have money. There's nothing else. And if we can't get some of this money, they're not worth becoming and remaining our partners in the Middle East. And Mohammed bin Salman has the same vision. He thinks that with his money, he could actually buy the world, buy power, buy status, and destroy Yemen, and also made Qatar a dependent little state that simply follows his orders. But all of this hasn't happened. And Mohammed bin Salman is actually miscalculated this war in Yemen. And 3 years later, he hasn't brought the Houthis, his rivals in Yemen, who are supported by the Iranians, down to their knees. At the same time, we find that since June 2017, the Qatar crisis is ongoing. The Qatar emir hasn't been expelled from the country. The Qataris are not starving. In fact, what Mohammed bin Salman wanted is to limit Iranian influence in the Arabian Peninsula. What he has done with the crisis in Qatar is make Qatar actually closer to Iran than to its neighbors in the Gulf, specifically Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. So quite a lot of these policies that Mohammed bin Salman has started are backfiring, and he must be feeling actually the pressure. He is in short of money. Despite Saudi Arabia's wealth, oil prices are still low. And for his projects, especially, for example, Neom City, which is like a phantasmagoria of a city that he plans to build by the on the Red Sea, and it's run by robots. It's almost like science fiction. These kind of projects are not generating employment for these young Saudis, and apparently 70% of them are under the age of 30. He even stated that his project on the Red Sea is not meant to generate employment for the Saudis. It's going to be a global hub like Dubai, whereby you will have to rely on foreign labor, foreign technology and expertise in order to make it happen. And it's not really clear how this particular city is going to benefit Saudis, not to mention the destruction of the environment and the pollution that it is going to create. And nobody knows whether it actually will have any residents in it. There are so many other models and failed experiments in building these cities in Saudi Arabia that remain empty. However, by starting these projects, a lot of people benefit economically, financially, including Mohammed bin Salman. Imagine the management consultancy firms, the bankers around the globe that are now wanting to be involved in order to cut deals and benefit. But whether this is beneficial for the country remains to be seen.
That is remarkable. And I should just note that there's been a lot of speculation about Jared Kushner visiting MBS just shortly before this consolidation of power. People are talking about the possibility that Trump has interests in backing MBS other than the obvious geopolitical interest in terms of putting the squeeze on Iran. So the regional context here seems a little bit bewildering on its face. It looks like MBS is taking a recklessly aggressive stance toward Iran at a moment where, as you mentioned, they're in the midst of this Saudi campaign in Yemen that's been condemned for its civilian casualties. The resignation of Saeed Hariri has plunged Lebanon into chaos. Is there a method to all of this, or is this about being young and brash and inexperienced?
Well, he's got ambition to be the final, first and last arbiter of Arab affairs from Beirut to Sana'a. But this is not going to happen. It's not going to happen for all sorts of reasons. One of them is that Iran is there and it is there to stay in the Middle East. And should Mohammed bin Salman be interested in peace and security in this region, he should come to the negotiating table with Iran to discuss how they could divide this region into different zones where they practice spheres of influence, and also refrain from interfering in other Arab countries' internal affairs. But it's not going to happen, because every time we think that there is a way out of this rivalry, which sounds like as if it's an eternal rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, we have a setback. So the latest setback was Saudi regime, who they summoned Saad al-Hariri, the prime minister, who's very, very close to the Saudi regime historically as a result of his father's financial interest, but also he's a Saudi citizen. He has dual nationality, so he's Lebanese and Saudi at the same time. And so he summoned him to Riyadh, where he announced his resignation. And throughout history, no prime minister would resign from another country unless he's trying to form a government in exile or during wartime. So Saad al-Hariri undermined himself, but perhaps he didn't have a choice. He was summoned and declared and announced that unexpectedly and abruptly that he is his resign. And the resignation is very important because Lebanon spent like 2 years without a president. And until they arrived at a kind of agreement between the various factions in the country, they formed a government and got a president elected. So Saad al-Hariri gives the regime in Lebanon some kind of legitimacy, because it means that all the factions, the sectarian groups, the Sunni, the Shia, the Christians, are all in government. So by pulling Saad al-Hariri from government, the Saudis hope that the Lebanese political agreement will collapse. And therefore, he, Mohammed bin Salman, could blame Iran for that and Hezbollah.
One final question before I let you go. There were a number of powerful figures arrested last weekend or detained. You mentioned Prince Maktoum bin Abdullah, who had been seen as a possible successor to the throne. There was billionaire investor Prince Al-Walid bin Talal. How does this end? I mean, they're being detained in a hotel, in a four-star hotel. They must have their own power bases. What is the end game here? They can't just detain them indefinitely, right?
Nobody knows. According to the Saudi press, there would be fair trials in inverted commas, and they'll be sidelined or basically disappear into oblivion, like Mohammed bin Nayef, who was expelled from his office in July. And since then, we haven't heard anything about him. He has not spoken to the media. He hasn't appeared anywhere, which means that he's under house arrest somewhere in the kingdom or on an island in the Red Sea. So those 11 princes may face the same fate. In addition to all the Saudis who are detained, let's not forget, it is very, very sad to see how the international community is so worried about those 11 princes. And we forget that there are hundreds of Saudis detained in Saudi prisons simply because of their opinion. So they are political prisoners.
Professor, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to offer your insights into what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. If you write something, could you please send me the link?
I certainly will.
Okay, great. Thanks. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you. Pleasure. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Gabriel Zuckman.
To work and now you're all dressed up, of course, inhaling cabs out of your door. On 14th Street I feel my head between my knees, an orange swimming through the cheese, an orange swimming through the cheese. Where could I go? What could I do? Put in the state. My lips and eyes give me away, and now there's nothing I can say. No, I'm pulled away. I see another of myself. It's found true love and happiness to sit and smoke down the jet. For two boys, one to kiss your neck and one to bring you back. Just get you out of bed when you're so. Should have spoken, but I lied. As I sat there with my jaw open and I smiled, he pulled his sweater off and tried to explain how we're giving up on love. I'm pulled away, I see another of myself who's found true love and happiness to sit and smoke there on the chair. Beside the bed, I read this past week's New Yorker and watching Pain Antarctica, watching Pain Antarctica. Two boys, one to kiss your neck and one to bring you breakfast. Get you out of bed when you're sore from the night before, from knocking on my door, your head against the floorboards. Two boys, one to love you sweetly, one does so discreetly. Never will they meet me, but I'm sure that you'll catch your breath. You'll sleep until the day to wake.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm pleased to be joined by Gabriel Zuckman. He's a professor at UC Berkeley, and he's also the author of The Hidden Wealth of Nations, The Scourge of Tax Havens. That was published in 2015 by the University of Chicago Press. Professor Zuckman, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin at the beginning of this increasingly prominent story about the so-called Paradise Papers. What is Appleby, and what are these papers, and how did we come to know about all of this stuff?
Appleby is an offshore law firm that advises rich individuals and multinational corporations about how to avoid or evade taxes. And it's a relatively important player in that market. There's apparently been a leak of data from that firm. I don't know the details. I think nobody knows what has happened exactly. But these journalists from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalism have obtained access to these leaks. And so they're running a number of stories about both tax avoidance by big multinational firms like Apple, and also wealth being held and sometimes hidden offshore by very wealthy individuals.
Now, it's not news that wealthy individuals and corporations are holding piles of cash offshore to avoid paying taxes on them. Americans for Tax Fairness estimates that American companies are holding $2.1 trillion in profits in various tax havens around the world. David K. Johnston, the great former New York Times reporter, and others have written about how the very wealthiest Americans, those at the top 10th of 1%, often pay pennies on the dollar in taxes. What new facts have come to light with the release of these documents, or is it just the kind of sordid details that are worth digging into?
No, I think these revelations just show very concretely in a number of cases how tax avoidance and tax evasion is done. There are a number of stories that are particularly interesting. One thing I found striking is the story on Apple. In 2014, they learned that they would not be able anymore to pay zero taxes or close to zero taxes in Ireland because Ireland announced that it would terminate an arrangement known as the Double Irish by 2020. And so immediately what Apple did is that they asked this firm, Appleby, to design for them a brand new tax shelter, and you know, Appleby duly obliged, and they created this new tax shelter in Jersey. And it was just, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, which shows that despite, you know, what these multinationals keep saying, they always say that they're paying taxes everywhere they have to, they're not trying to aggressively minimize their tax bill. What they do is precisely the opposite. They're very aggressively trying to pay as little as 0% on billions of dollars in profits.
And one of the things that I find particularly frustrating about that story is that companies like Apple rely quite a bit on publicly funded research, and then they get out of paying their taxes. And I think most people don't understand how corporations use the tax code to actually turn a profit. We talk about companies like Apple or GE avoiding taxes, but with the current tax law, they're allowed to park trillions of dollars in profits offshore without paying taxes on them unless they bring those dollars back. So it's like an interest-free loan, in a sense, an indefinite interest-free loan. And if you can take out an interest-free loan for an indefinite period of time, you can invest it and pocket the proceeds of those investments. Do you think people understand this dynamic?
I mean, it's even more than an interest-free loan because all these profits that are parked offshore, in principle, they're supposed to be taxed upon repatriation in the U.S. at a rate of 35%, but they will never be taxed at this 35% rate. So if the tax bill of the Republican House becomes law, they will be taxed at a rate of 12%, which is almost three times lower. In 2005, these big multinational companies were able to repatriate their offshore earnings at a rate of 5.25%. So in practice, all these profits that they managed to book in places like Ireland, Jersey, Cayman Islands, and so on, they face really tiny tax rates. And that's the reason why the artificial shifting of profits to low or zero tax places has kept growing over the last years and decades. So right now, in 2016, the latest available data, 63% of all the foreign profits made by U.S. firms were recorded in just six low or zero tax jurisdictions. And that's an increase from about 20% in the 1980s, and it keeps growing year after year. Year after year, they manage to book a bigger fraction of their global profits in these tiny Caribbean or European islands.
Now, when you say they'll never be repatriated at full tax at the full tax rate, it seems to me that they effectively hold this money hostage. What they say is, we are not going to bring this money back until you give us a so-called tax holiday, a reduced rate, and we won't be able to invest it in the United States and improving our plants, et cetera, until you give us this break. And then they run up, if they do get a tax holiday, they repatriate some money, and then they run up the their offshore accounts again and start the whole process over again. Is that an accurate summary?
That's definitely what has happened. Last time they had a tax holiday in 2005. So there's been a number of studies that have looked into this. What we see is that when the multinationals were given the right to repatriate with this special rate of 5.25%, there was no more investment in the U.S. There was no increase in wages. There was just a big increase in dividend payments to shareholders. And so it's just, you know, no real effect on the real economy. And what has happened after that is that profit shifting to tax havens has increased, you know, even more than before 2005. And then multinationals have spent more and more money trying to lobby Congress to get another special tax rate, tax holiday. And that's where we are at this stage.
Now, this is all taking place in the context of Republican efforts to reform the tax system. The House bill that was passed last week is projected to increase budget deficits by, I believe it was $1.7 trillion over the next 10 years. And one of the reasons for that is that they watered down a provision in the original bill because of lobbying by corporations that would have cracked down on tax avoidance through offshore tax havens. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I mean, the new bill that's proposed by the House is actually quite a radical change compared to the current system, in the sense that it would move the U.S. toward a so-called territorial tax system, in which profits that are recorded outside of the U.S. are not taxed in the U.S. Right now, in principle, U.S. firms are taxable on their worldwide profits, except that in practice, they only pay taxes on their foreign profits upon repatriation. But in the bill, the U.S. would simply give up trying to tax foreign profits at all. There's a provision that says that multinationals would still have to pay a minimum tax of 10% on their foreign profits, but there are many exemptions. And so in practice, it would become easy for firms to pay zero or close to 0% on whatever profits they manage to report outside of the U.S. And that's a deeply perverse system, because it gives incentives to firms to artificially shift their profits out of the U.S. and claim that these profits have been made abroad in Ireland, in the Cayman Islands, or in Bermuda. If they manage to do that, and if the bill becomes law, they will be able to pay literally 0% on a big chunk of their profits.
And I would just point out the obvious, I would make the obvious point that this is such a contradiction with the current government's talk of economic nationalism, America first, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's really an egregious egregious violation of the promise that they made with their own voters. So Senate Republicans are considering this territorial taxation. It is a longtime corporate dream. Let me ask you this. When we talk about a company like Apple moving its profits first to Ireland, and now to the island of Jersey, they're not selling products in those markets. How are they moving the profits to these low tax havens on paper when they're not actually conducting an enormous amount of business in those places?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, there is very few sales that actually occur in those islands, very few customers, obviously, in Bermuda or in Jersey. So the way this works is that they manipulate the price of their intragroup transactions. So they export, let's say, from the U.S. at artificially low prices towards Ireland, and they import from Ireland at artificially high prices. So that shifts profits out of the U.S. and towards Ireland. So that's one way this is done. The other way, which is very important for these big internet and IT companies, is to locate intangible assets like algorithms or logos or trademarks in subsidiaries in low-tax countries. And so, for instance, Google moved its IP, its intellectual property, in 2003, before even being listed as a public company, to its Bermuda subsidiary. And so since then, all the profits that are generated by these search and advertisement technologies, they accrue to this Bermuda company. And so in 2015, we know that Google made $15.5 billion in profits in Bermuda, where the corporate tax rate is 0%. And what I'd like to say, which I think is most important, is there is actually a simple fix to this problem, which is that we could start from the global consolidated profits of firms, and we could apportion those profits to each country proportionally to where sales are made. And so think about Apple, for instance. If they make $100 billion in profits globally and 50% of their sales in the U.S., then we could say, okay, 50% of their profits are going, of their global profits are going to be taxed in the U.S. We're going to consider that they make 50% of their profits in the U.S. And you immediately see the beauty of this system. It would put an end to this tax avoidance, because right now Apple can move its profits to Jersey, but cannot move its customers to Jersey. The customers, they are in the U.S., they are in Germany, they are in France. And so with the system that I describe, we would put an end to corporate tax avoidance.
And is there a movement in the international community to enact that kind of system?
Not yet, but my hope is that with the revelations that we see, these Paradise Papers this year, previous leaks last year, the Panama Papers, before that the Lux leaks, with revelations like that, there's going to be growing awareness among the public that the current system of taxing multinational firms does not work, and we need to fix it, and there actually exists a simple fix. And this fix, you know, any country could adopt it unilaterally. So the U.S. could next year say, that's going to be the way we tax multinational corporations. We don't need international cooperation. We don't need a multilateral agreement to agree on that. It's just changing the way we compute the amount of profits that are taxable in the U.S. And any other country, France or Germany, could do the same unilaterally.
Professor, before I let you go, let me ask you this final question. Do we know how much tax revenues we are losing under the current system compared to the kind of system that you're articulating right now?
Yes, for the U.S. loses about $70 billion a year due to the artificial shifting of profits to tax havens. That's about 20% of all the corporate tax revenue collected by the U.S. And so with the system that I described, the corporate tax revenue, keeping the tax rate constant, could increase by 20%.
And ladies and gentlemen, there has been a shift since the end of World War II from corporate taxation to individual taxation. It's very important to understand that when corporations avoid 20% of their tax burden, they are actually shifting that burden onto households. It's not that those taxes are not made up somewhere else. They're shifted from corporations to individuals. Professor, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights on this.
Thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank Madawi Al-Rashid for joining us. Turns out we don't have enough time to talk about last week's elections, but there will be plenty of election talk as we move into 2018. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I would like to thank the good people at Crooks and Liars and Digby's Hullabaloo and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Tous les jours. Parfois j'aimerais mourir tellement y'a plus d'espoir. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour plus jamais te revoir. Parfois j'aimerais mourir pour ne plus rien savoir. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour.
Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus tous les jours. Je ne t'aime plus, mon amour. Je ne t'aime plus.